resources to effectuate immigration laws. And that's what these laws are designed to protect and prohibit. They've been upheld in Oregon in the past as being constitutional. And so we expect that to continue moving forward. Right now, there's a policy disagreement between the federal government and the states about how they want to interact. But I feel very confident in saying that Oregonians want their law enforcement going after the essential public safety things. Burglary, murder, the big crimes in our communities to make sure that we're keeping our community safe. And we want people in Oregon feeling comfortable and safe talking to law enforcement and going to our courthouses to testify to keep our community safe.
Dan Rayfield, want to thank you for being with us. Oregon Attorney General speaking to us from Salem, Oregon. He's leading the multi-state lawsuit against Trump's tariffs. When we come back, the Trump administration tried to deport as many as 700 unaccompanied Guatemalan children in the middle of the night over Labor Day weekend. We'll speak with the lawyer who helped stop them. Well, for now, stay with us.
Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar. No sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. O se atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no importa para el tío Sam.
Yellow Ice by La Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the Trump administration's attempt to illegally deport as many as 700 Guatemalan children in the dead of night over Labor Day weekend. The move was temporarily halted at the last minute by a federal judge. The National Immigration Law Center filed an emergency request to stop the deportation flights, arguing the children who arrived in the U.S. without their parents would face harm and abuse if they were returned to Guatemala. Many of the children are now living in shelters and foster care. One 10-year-old said in a court filing, quote, "I do not have any family in Guatemala that can take good care of me." A 16-year-old said she faced, quote, "threats against my life in Guatemala, saying if I'm sent back, I believe I will be in danger," unquote. Over the weekend, some of the kids were loaded onto planes that waited on the tarmac in South Texas. U.S. District Judge Sparkle Suknanan said she was awakened at 2:35 a.m. to address an emergency filing from the children's lawyers who warned the flights might leave within hours. The judge held a hearing Sunday saying, quote, "I have the government attempting to remove minor children from the country in the wee hours of the morning on a holiday weekend, which is surprising," she said. This all comes as the Trump administration insists it's reuniting the Guatemalan children at their country's request with their families who sought their return. On Monday, Guatemala's president said his country's ready to receive the unaccompanied children. For more, we're joined from McAllen, Texas, near the U.S.-Mexico border, by Efrain Olivares, an attorney representing the Guatemalan children. He's vice president of litigation at the National Immigration Law Center. Efrain, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain exactly what took place. I mean, this is so dramatic. Over a holiday weekend in the middle of the night, a judge is woken up at 2:35 in the morning. Explain here what's at stake.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me. That's exactly right. We started hearing rumors that there were plans to remove Guatemalan children in OIR custody, in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. These are unaccompanied children who do not have a parent or a guardian with them. And we started putting together a challenge to try to stop it because that is unlawful. There are laws, there are protections for unaccompanied minors that provide how a child can be released from custody, to whom, and the process if they want to go back to their country. There are very well-established processes that have been in place since at least 2008 with bipartisan support. And the later in the day, keep in mind, this is Saturday of Labor Day weekend. So the later in the day, the more and more information we were getting that there were plans to pick up the children. So after 11 o'clock, the shelters received a notification from headquarters of the Office of Refugee Resettlement to have their children ready within 2 hours or 4 hours for pickup. If this were a benign repatriation to send children back to their parents, it wouldn't be happening at midnight on Sunday of Labor Day weekend. So we filed that lawsuit at around 1 o'clock in the morning and a temporary restraining order simultaneously, and then followed the court's emergency procedure, calling the court at 2 o'clock. Somebody got a hold of the judge at 2:30, and that's how we ended up here.
And could you, Evren, could you explain the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which was, I think, central to your argument to the court?
Exactly. That is precisely the law passed in 2008 with widespread bipartisan support that protects unaccompanied minors. And the idea behind that law is that young immigrant children who come to the U.S. without a parent or without either parent are very susceptible to exploitation, trafficking. So in order to protect those children from that, there are very clearly established processes. For example, if an adult requests what is called voluntary departure, they can return to their home country. If a child requests voluntary departure, an immigration judge has to approve that. A child advocate has to make a best interest determination to ensure that returning the child is in the best interest of the child, does not place the child in danger. The child is what is called of a tender age. There's additional protections so that an assessment can be made, presented to the immigration judge, and only then does the judge allow that to go forward. And then there are procedures also to make sure that there's somebody back home to receive the children, a proper adult, government authorities. This does not happen in the middle of the night in a rush without informing anyone. Poor children, right? They were woken up in the middle of the night, put in a bus, taken to the airport, and were there for hours not knowing what was going to happen to them. Luckily, the children were not unlawfully deported. We have 14 days to properly look at the situation and then determine the next steps.
And where are these children now? Were they returned to the shelters where they were being held?
They were. All the children who were on those planes are now back in ORR custody, according to the government. That's what the government has reported, and we have confirmed as much.
And Efrain Olivares, can you give us a more complete description of who these kids are, where they are throughout the United States?
We have plaintiffs in Texas, in California, Pennsylvania, New York, and the class is nationwide of all unaccompanied Guatemalan children in ORR custody. They are in shelters all over the country, right? Florida, Louisiana, Nevada, Arizona, there's Chicago, all over the country as this happens, right? That is normal. So, and they vary in age from at least 7 to 17. There have some arrived a couple of months ago this summer. Some arrived longer than that a few months ago, and they have been in ORR custody since then. The vast majority of them have pending immigration cases. They have open immigration cases. An immigration judge has not determined their claims. Some are eligible for asylum. Some are eligible for what's called a special immigrant juvenile visa. That's when reunification with one or both parents is not possible. So it just varies a lot. The one common denominator here is twofold. They are all children, and they are Guatemalan.
And your response to the Guatemalan president, Arevalo, saying that they're welcome to come back to Guatemala, what the children are saying about returning and whose custody they're in right now in the United States?
They are currently in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a federal agency, part of the Department of Health and Human Services. That is where they are supposed to be as unaccompanied minors. The Guatemalan government updated their statement to specify that they welcome any children who wants to return. And some of the children may want to return, and there are processes to be followed in order to do that orderly, not in the middle of the night over a holiday weekend without proper notice. There are processes, and that's what we're asking the court. Require the government to follow the process required by law. Nothing more. The law is there, has been there for 20 years. Let's just follow the law, follow the normal process. And once that happens, there's no problem if a child is returned, right? But some children, keep in mind, have asylum claims. They fear persecution in Guatemala, right? So some children do not want to return. And not only do they not want to return, they fear returning because their life, their personal safety is in danger. So it is not true that all the children want to return.
Efrén Olivares, I want to thank you so much for being with us, attorney representing the unaccompanied Guatemalan children, many of whom President Trump has attempted to have deported this past weekend, Labor Day weekend, in the middle of the night. Efrén Olivares is vice president of litigation at the National Immigration Law Center, previously with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Program. His book, My Boy Will Die of Sorrow, A Memoir of Immigration from the Front Lines. He was speaking to us from the U.S.-Mexico border in McAllen, Texas. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the Israeli airstrike in Yemen that killed Yemen's Houthi prime minister, defense minister, and other officials. And we'll talk about Gaza with Rami Khoury. Stay with us.
Jedar mange kukre, jedar mange kukre. Jedar mange kukre, jedar mange kukre. Meli kasam sune, jano jo, na pucho jati.
Jano Jot by Sunny Singh, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Yemen, thousands of mourners attended a funeral today for 12 senior Houthi figures who were killed by Israel in an airstrike Thursday. The dead included the Houthi prime minister, Ahmed Ghaleb al-Rawi, the Houthi military leadership that holds most decision-making power was not targeted. Israel's previously targeted Houthi ports and infrastructure. The Iran-backed Houthi rebels began launching missiles at Israel, most of which have been intercepted, and attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea after the start of Israel's war on Gaza in what they have called actions in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The Houthis have controlled Sana'a and much of northern Yemen since 2014. This is Omar al-Bukhaiti, Houthi Deputy Minister of Information.
Our message today to those inside and abroad is a message of challenge and steadfastness, and that we are standing side by side with our revolutionary and political leadership. We present a convoy of martyrs to join the ranks of the martyrs of the leadership of the government of change and construction. Many have gone and many will come. We will make sacrifices for the sake of the cause, for the sake of the challenge, for the sake of the steadfastness with our brothers in the Gaza Strip.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the retaliation campaign against the Houthis. He addressed the Israeli Security Cabinet on Sunday.
The Houthi terror regime is learning the hard way that it is paying and will continue to pay a very heavy price for its aggression against the state of Israel. Whoever attacks us, we attack them. Whoever plans to attack us, we attack them. I believe the entire region is learning about the strength and determination of the state of Israel.
To discuss this and more, we go to Rami Khoury. He is a Palestinian-American journalist who's covered the Middle East for 5 decades, distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., joining us from Newton, Massachusetts. Rami, thanks so much for being with us. Can you talk about the significance of this Israeli strike on Yemen on Thursday, and who exactly was killed?
Well, thanks for having me. The strike was significant in several ways. It's not a big deal that Israel is killing leaders in different Arab countries all around the region. They've been doing that for decades. It is significant that they are doing this now after there's been a bit of a lull in Yemeni attacks by Ansarullah, the Houthis. The Americans more or less pulled out of that war in Yemen. And now there is a big signal that Israel is sending that they're going to go after top leaders in any country that they feel threatens Israel. So it's significant that they've done this. They know that the attacks haven't really impacted much in Yemen in the sense that the people who were killed, even though they were senior officials, were not major decision-making people. The decisions in Yemen are really in the hands of the political leadership council, which is headed by the head of the Ansarullah movement, and the people in the government, the prime minister, the defense minister, and others carry out the policies that are set by this higher political council. So the impact is really to signal to the Yemenis and everybody else in the region that Israel will keep attacking anybody, will kill senior people. They don't care about any laws or reprisals. And this is a troubling fact because it just means that endless war is one of the possibilities that we might face in this region.
Yeah, and Rami, I wanted to ask you precisely about that. This continued expansion of the targets of Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, in addition to the genocide that they're perpetrating in Gaza and the continued attacks in the West Bank. What is the impact of this continued expansion of its targets and of the leaders of these various countries on the rest of the Arab government and leaders of the Middle East?
Well, this is significant because the Yemenis have been involved in attacking Israel since the Gaza genocide started. They say it's to support the Palestinians and to put pressure on the Israelis to stop the genocide. Hezbollah said the same thing, that they're attacking to help the Palestinians. The minute that Israel stops the genocide, both Hezbollah and Ansarullah in Yemen said they would stop attacking Israel or Israeli targets. This is different now. This is a Israeli-Yemeni conflict, not a conflict in which Yemen is supporting Gaza and Palestinians. And this is the danger here, that we've seen this going on for the last probably 10 years or so, that the center of gravity of the Israeli-Palestinian the Zionist-Arabism conflict has expanded from its core in Palestine for the last 75 years, is now involved in Syria, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, and other places possibly. And this is what's really dangerous about this, because it might also bring in the Americans again if the Ansarullah keep attacking ships. They attacked a ship yesterday, a cargo ship off the Saudi coast. And this, of course, disrupts international shipping. It has strategic implications, economic implications for the whole world, which usually means the U.S. is going to step in, because if U.S. economic dominance in the world is ever threatened, it takes action, because that's its most important goal. So this is very significant as a symbol of the expanding conflict. And it also reminds us that the Israelis have never had a strategy about how to coexist, how a Jewish majority Israeli state, which they created in 1948, how that could coexist, not just with the Palestinians, but with everybody else in the region. They've never had a strategy. Their strategy has been military force, relying on Western imperial powers, first the British, and then after the 50s, the Americans, and intimidating people, killing as many people. And now the next level, of course, genocide in Gaza. The Israelis could possibly take part of Yemen. I would guess they're going to probably take Hodeidah, the port, which is strategic for imports in Yemen, and just destroy it, turn it into rubble like they've done in Gaza. I wouldn't put this beyond them. And whether or not this brings about any reaction from the Western, alleged Western democracies who care about human rights, remains to be seen.
And in almost all media coverage of what happens in Yemen, the country is always referred to as the Iranian-backed Houthis in control of Yemen. We never, for instance, talk about the U.S.-backed Israel in our media accounts of what Israel does. What exactly is the relationship between the Houthis and the Iranian government?
The Iranian government has clearly helped the Yemenis. Ansarullah is the name of the movement. They've helped them a lot strategically, technologically, in other ways, training. The Yemenis produce a lot of their own military hardware, some of their missiles and other things. They've also got very sophisticated protection capabilities because of the landscape in Yemen, because of the size of the country. It's massive, full of mountains and valleys and rivers and wadis. So they're able to protect their resources better than, say, the Hamas could or Hezbollah could. The Yemenis have relied heavily on the Iranians and also on Hezbollah. Hezbollah did some of the training of the Ansarullah fighters and the technology. So there is a strategic relationship between Iran and all of the groups in the Arab world that were part of what Iran called the resistance axis, which took a big hit in the last 2 years. But as we see, they're still there. They're still fighting. They're still making a statement. And we don't know where this is going to lead. But it could very well lead to a much bigger war in the region and could again draw in the Iranians and the Americans.
And Rami Khoury, the two governments, one the Houthi government in which the prime minister was just killed by Israel, what level of popular support do they each have in Yemen?
Well, the Ansarullah government that the Houthis created in the north of Yemen controls much of the northern part of Yemen, and the so-called internationally recognized government is the way it's called, who are based in Aden in the south. They control some of the southern regions, some of which are oil-producing regions and strategic port areas. The Ansarullah government, like most Arab governments, is not a democratic force. It is there because it took over in a military coup some years ago, and they enforce their incumbency and their rule by autocratic means. And now they've stepped that up, by the way, in the last couple of months. There's much more internal monitoring, repression, arrests, because they're being attacked, as we saw earlier this week. And they have a lot of support, but they don't have unanimous support. And this is something that applies to all governments in the Arab world, that they have some genuine support, but not unanimous. And there's people in North Yemen who'd rather not have perpetual warfare as their destiny, but they can't do anything about it. And in the south, of course, it's the same thing. The people in the south who are headed by various former officials in unified Yemen with Yemeni support, with Saudi support, and United Arab Emirates support. The UAE has a kind of a base in the south of Yemen now, and some international support. These are not, wildly loved democratic movements, but they are in power. And people like, many people in Yemen, North Yemen, like the fact that they resist, even though they're going to get the hell, you know, beaten up really badly, because this is what the Israelis and the Americans do. They use their military power. But they like the resistance is a part of their philosophy, part of their DNA. And the Yemenis have been resisting for about the last 2,000 years. They've had all kinds of, every, you know, colonial, imperial, regional power has tried to attack them. Even from the Romans in the first century, there was a Roman general who tried to go down and take over the spice routes, and they threw him out. This is part of the regional scene.
Rami Khoury, I wanted to ask you about Gaza and the West Bank. The latest news, Israeli attacks since dawn have killed at least 54 Palestinians, including people seeking food. The attacks coming as Gaza health officials recorded another 13 deaths due to starvation, three of them kids, bringing the number of starvation deaths in Gaza to more than 360. According to a leading global monitor, more than half a million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are suffering catastrophic hunger due to Israel's blockade. This comes as the world's leading genocide scholars association has approved a resolution establishing Israel's policies in action in Gaza meet the legal definition of genocide as found in the Genocide Convention, constituting war crimes and crimes against humanity. I want to play for you Melanie O'Brien, president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars.
This resolution declaring what is happening in Gaza as genocide passed by an overwhelming majority, far beyond the two-thirds majority required.
Rami Khoury, if you can respond to this genocide finding by the largest genocide scholars association and the conditions in Gaza, and now what I think it's been established, something like 42,000 Palestinians in the West Bank have been displaced, and the killings by Israeli settlers of Palestinians continues.
Yeah, first of all, what the Israelis are doing in the West Bank and Gaza and elsewhere in East Jerusalem is nothing new. It's just a bigger scale, and it's more out in the open. It's reported now, especially by social media, and even Western mainstream media has started to talk about it. Progressive media, honest media like yourselves, have been talking about it for many years, but the world sees now what has been happening in Gaza, and we keep sending the message that this has been going on since the 1930s, when the Zionist movement came in and said we want a Jewish state in a land that was 93% Arab Palestinian. But this is an ongoing genocide. And the statement by the International Association of Genocide Scholars is very significant, not at the level that is going to suddenly stop the genocide, but it's significant because of the nature of this group. I talked yesterday to my friend Omer Bartov, who you've had on your show. He's a leading Israeli-American genocide and Holocaust scholar, teaches at Brown University. And I asked him, why is this important? And he said, it's important because the nature of this group, this association is a relatively conservative group. There's another more leftist, progressive, dynamic association. But these guys are pretty low key. They're careful about what they do. And the fact that they came out with such a big majority, I think 85% of them voted that Israel is carrying out a genocide. That's significant because it makes it pretty obvious to the whole world, if anybody needed more proof, that even conservative scholars, independent, serious students of this gruesome process of genocide and Holocaust and mass atrocities, they are coming right out and saying this is a genocide. The big question is what will happen next.
We have 10 seconds.
Will any of the major Western powers take action? Will the signatories of the Genocide Convention do what they're supposed to do, which is stop the genocide by any means possible?
Rami Khoury, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American journalist, public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tadasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.